Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear arguments from petitioners in Mattridge v. Ross.
May it please the court, Mr. Bill Boyce and Mr. Andy Hanen will present arguments for petitioners. Mr. Boyce will open, and Mr. Hanen will present a 5-minute rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Bill Boyce, and I'll be presenting the first portion of petitioner's argument. Mr. Hanen will present the rebuttal. The petitioners are also represented in court this morning by Mr. Steve Lay. The problem that brings us here is a recurring one, and it occurs when multiple claims are asserted against multiple parties, who in turn file multiple motions for summary judgment. The Court of Appeals in this matter concluded that in this case, certain parties not before this court failed to address all causes of action asserted against them in their respective motions for summary judgment. The petitioners, the parties before this court this morning, do not concede that they themselves failed to address any particular cause of action. But for purposes of argument this morning, we start with the assumption that parties not before this court did fail to address certain causes of action, raising the question, is there a final summary judgment in this situation? And more broadly, how are courts to determine when there is a final summary judgment and when instead is just interlocutory? The petitioners have proposed some clarifying language, which they ask this court to endorse, language that we submit does not overrule any particular case, does not overrule any particular theory. In fact, fits very comfortably within the mainstream of the law interpreting finality. But what it will do is promote clarity, we assert, because it focuses on an important distinction that has become muddled in some of the case law, particularly cases decided since the Teer v. Duddleston decision. And that is the distinction between determining whether a judgment is final and whether it is correct. The argument that the Court of Appeals seemed to be endorsing below, even though it professed to be following Teer, is an argument that says a district court cannot grant summary judgment on a cause of action if there's no motion for summary judgment addressed to that cause of action. Because the district court cannot do it, the district court did not do it. And because the district court did not dispose of a particular cause of action, there is an interlocutory rather than a final summary judgment. We submit to the court that this approach to the problem is commingling these two separate concepts, finality and propriety of a motion for summary judgment. Nothing in what the petitioners are proposing would address or affect the standard of review for summary judgments. It would not make them easier to get. It would not make them easier to keep. But what it would do is focus courts and focus litigants on where the real fight is, namely, is a particular summary judgment proper under particular facts and in particular circumstances.
Under your proposed standard, what pieces of paper in the transcript would the Court of Appeals or this court have to look at to determine the finality of the judgment?
There is no set magic words that would allow this court or a court of appeals to look at just one piece of paper or just a couple of pieces of paper.
You can't just look at the judgment.
The answer to your question is it depends on the circumstances. And what we're saying is the standard that we propose would allow courts to look at the judgment and at the bare wording of the judgment or particular orders that combine to make a final judgment as a starting point. Part of the confusion right now has been whether finality language, whether Mother Hubbard language is appropriate in a situation where not all causes of action have been addressed. And what we're saying is, to clarify this distinction between finality and propriety, allow courts, explicitly allow courts and litigants to look as a first instance at the wording of the orders. Sometimes that may resolve it, because that's the application of the standard in this case, under these facts, where we assert that a summary judgment order stating that a non-movement shall take nothing or recover nothing makes it a final and appealable judgment as to any claim, counterclaim, cross-claim that the non-movement has pled against the movement.
So if a judgment says plaintiff take nothing, summary judgment, you don't need to look farther to determine the finality of the judgment?
If you have a situation where Plaintiff asserts causes of action against defendant. There are no counterclaims being asserted by the defendant. There's no cross-claims among defendants. In this circumstance, and we submit to you that this language will allow a court to determine finality looking at the face of the judgment.
So at least you would not have to examine the petition and the motion to see whether it takes care of each claim or cause of action alleged.
In this particular circumstance, that would be correct.
You'd still have to look at counterclaims, cross-claims, cross-actions.
That's right, and we're not offering this as a cure-all for any situation involving finality questions and summary judgments.
Well, that's too bad.
But we are saying that it would be a significant ability to offer a significant chance to offer some clarity in this particular circumstance. And again, to stress that the point here is not to affect the standard of review for summary judgment, not to try to make it easier, but to allow the parties to focus their fire where it belongs, namely whether it was appropriate in a particular circumstance. And we submit that in addressing this language and proposing it, that it fits comfortably within the cases that have discussed finality up to this point. If we take as a starting point somewhere something that I think everyone will agree with, that a summary judgment is not final unless it disposes of all cases and all parties, all causes of action, and all parties before the court. That was the holding of Pan American, and it's been widely quoted since then. The next step in the progression is this court's decision in Aldridge v. Northeast ISD. A couple of significant points we want to make about Aldridge, and this ties into the discussion of Tier in just a moment. Aldridge does not preclude the use of Mother Hubbard-type language in summary judgments. It explicitly applies the type of language because Aldridge itself was a summary judgment case. The liability was decided on summary judgment and then damages were stipulated at a later time. But nothing in Aldridge precludes the use of finality language for summary judgment purposes. And more importantly, nothing in Aldridge equates the use of Mother Hubbard language with presumptive finality. As we tried to stress in the brief, Mother Hubbard language or similar language, in this instance, take nothing or recover nothing, allows litigants to avoid having to play the presumptions game, allows them to avoid having to make guesses and look at the face of the document, the orders granting summary judgment. If it purports to be a final summary judgment taking care of all claims, then we'll take it at face value and address the merits. Did it properly do so? Did the parties actually move for summary judgment on the grounds that they were granted? This court recognized the reach of Aldridge in the Schlipp v. Exxon decision. In a per curiam denial of an application for writ, it explicitly endorsed the use of Mother Hubbard-type language in summary judgments. And we contend that that is the kind of standard that will help resolve this confusion and allow parties to get to the merits. The problem is that this runs into some language in Tier v. Dettleston, decided 2 years after Schlipp. And the ironic thing here is that Tier does exactly what we contend should be done in this situation. It treats it as a final judgment and then looks at individual parties and says, was summary judgment proper as to party 1, 2, or 3? For those that it was proper, they are affirmed. For those that it was improper, they are reversed and remanded. It goes right to the heart of the merits as opposed to getting lost in this procedural limbo about whether or not it's final. But we submit that Tier is creating confusion for several significant reasons. Number one, particularly at page 704 of Tier, it moves very quickly from talking about the merits and whether it's proper to grant summary judgment on a cause of action that's not addressed or for a party who hasn't moved for summary judgment, and then slides very quickly into finality discussions and includes the famous language about no Mother Hubbard clause, conventional trial on the merits, and so forth. And then it slides back to the merits again and saying the trial court erred. The court in Tier reversed and remanded, not unlike this court did last month in the McConnell decision, concluding that summary judgment was improperly granted. There was jurisdiction, but it was reversed and remanded as to that portion that was erroneous. Tier is creating confusion in a couple of respects. When Tier tries to draw a distinction between the use of finality language in conventional trials on the merits, equating that with a jury trial, and then says, but this language does not apply to summary judgments, we submit that a faithful reading of Chief Justice Calvert's opinion in Aldridge shows that's not the distinction he was drawing. He was drawing a distinction with this reference to a case set for a conventional trial on the merits. The distinction there is between dismissals on the merits, such as by jury trial, summary judgment, and dispositions by other means, such as a dismissal, a non-suit, plea and abatement, something of that nature. That's the distinction, and there's nothing in the reading of Aldridge that precludes the use of finality language in summary judgment situations. And as noted earlier, we believe that Teer is fostering confusion among the courts of appeals with its reference to Mother Hubbard language, and that this is an inappropriate presumption of finality. As explained in Chief Justice Calvert's opinion, Mother Hubbard language avoids the problem altogether. Take the judgment, take the order at face value. If there's more than one order, take them collectively at face value and see if they comport.
Sorry, your position, you would give some, rather than having Mother Hubbard in there just to announce that the court intends to make this a final judgment, you would give some substantive merits to Mother Hubbard. Let me give you an example. Motion summary judgments presented to trial court. Trial court signed in one sentence order. The motion summary judgment is hereby granted. Is that a final order or not?
It would depend on the circumstances. What we are saying is not that.
Why would that depend? What does it depend on?
If there is no, let me back up for a moment.
Let me suggest that it depends on whether the motion addresses all the causes and all the parties, correct?
Correct.
Your position is that if I sign an order that says motion summary judgment granted, all of the relief not specifically granted is hereby denied, makes it final.
Yes.
Irrespective of what the motion raises.
We don't know
what claims have been raised. We don't know what claims have been denied. You can't tell until you go and consult the motion to see what motions are presented. You don't even know if there's been a counterclaim presented.
That's correct. But as this approach allows the courts and the litigants to look at the face of the order or the judgment as a starting point. If it does contain the requisite language of finality, then the concerns that you're raising can be addressed in determining whether to reverse or to affirm the summary judgment. Nothing here is going to run afoul of Rule 166A that says you've got to move for summary judgment on a ground to get summary judgment on a ground. But let me offer another hypothetical. We're not saying that this language is the only way to make a summary judgment final, or that a magic couple of words, a Mother Hubbard phrase, must be in the judgment to make it final. We're saying that when it does appear, that allows courts and litigants to go there as a first instance. To take your example, if you have a summary judgment order that says summary judgment is granted, period, in that circumstance, and nothing else, in that circumstance, you may well need to go and look at the pleadings and match them up against the motion to see if causes of action were addressed or not. But if there is the signal language of finality, that is the starting point, and we submit that that can help to resolve a lot of the confusion that has blossomed since the decision in Teer.
I don't understand. I guess I misunderstood. It gives you a starting point, but you can never stop there.
You might be able to stop there. In our situation, with the collective assembled orders, because they say take nothing or recover nothing, and there are no counterclaims and there are no cross-claims, in this circumstance, you can stop there because that shows the finality. If you've got a more vaguely drafted order, you may not be able to stop there, and I don't want to mislead the court and suggest that we're proposing this as a cure-all for finality problems. It will address this one particular area and we believe help to promote clarity in this area, and perhaps an endorsement of this kind of language will lead litigants and lead courts to include this language more often so that we don't have to get into the presumption game.
You still have to determine whether the motion addressed all parties, correct?
Yes, you do.
The major benefit that occurs to me is you just don't have to determine that it addressed all causes of action.
Again, it depends on the wording of a particular order. I'm not trying to be evasive. I'm trying to answer your question. If the order says plaintiffs shall take nothing against any defendant, that's as far as you have to go.
Against any defendant?
Yes, if that's the order that is entered. If, for example, in our situation, you have multiple orders that say, plaintiff shall take nothing against defendant one, shall take nothing against defendant two, and so on, in that case, you're going to have to look at the orders collectively.
Let me ask you this question, Mr. Boyd. Obviously, you're trying to set up a rule that prevents traps.
Correct.
For the unwary. It seems to me that in the current state of recognizing tears, confusing opinion, and in my view needs to be worked on. It seems to me now, all the attorneys, when they get a summary judgment that has some of the general language in there, have got to bring an appeal, because it could be a final judgment. But if they're wrong, then it's found interlocutory and no harm, no foul. It seems to me your rule, however, creates a trap that works the reverse. You go grab a form book for a judgment. You don't pay attention to it. You throw in a Mother Hubbard clause when nobody intends to make it a final judgment. The judge signs this. You proceed to trial on the balance of whatever may be out there in the case. You come back, and then one of the parties says, wait a minute. We've got this opinion, Mayfridge, out here that says general language makes it final. And so one party finds that because general language is in there, they take it up on appeal. Oh, I'm sorry. That was a final judgment on all claims and all actions. You failed to appeal, so you lose. Why, if we're really interested in avoiding traps, shouldn't we leave the trap that hasn't escaped with everybody feeling they've got to appeal, than to have a hard and fast rule that a general language in a, that doesn't specifically reference anything, but just general language like Mother Hubbard in there, thrown in this judgment, which gets done routinely in our practice in Texas, and slam the hammer down? Why should we fix it by creating a real serious problem?
I have a couple of responses to Your Honor's question. Number one, that the pitfall you identify is a potential problem. The answer to that is that it will require greater attention on the part of attorneys and the part of judges as they go through this process to be very clear about when they are seeking partial summary judgment or when they are granting partial summary judgment. There could be some harsh results in requiring this greater attention, but I submit to the court that it's no harsher to require attorneys to look closely at the judgments that they are submitting and the judgments that are being signed than it is in any other circumstance. For example, charge error. If you omit to object to an incorrect statement of the law or you object insufficiently, you can be held on appeal to a standard of law that everyone acknowledges is incorrect. But because you didn't follow the right steps, that law governs your appeal. That's no more harsh a result, we submit, than it is in this circumstance to put the onus upon the attorneys and the trial judges to think carefully about whether they really do intend to file a final summary judgment. In addition to that, you do have some lag time so that after the judgment is signed, within the district court's plenary power, it can still be modified to if the parties really did intend to sign a partial and interlocutory summary judgment and just get rid of one aspect of the case temporarily, that can be fixed. The broader answer to your question is that you're identifying harm, potential harm to particular litigants. The broader harm that we're experiencing right now is, as I've noticed, this procedural limbo where it wastes the litigant's time and it wastes the court's time. For example, in this situation, because there is a determination of no finality, if that sticks, everything goes back to the district court, and the district court has to look at not only what the court looked at already, but any other claims that were not addressed. And in turn, the courts of appeals are going to have to look at it one more time as well. There is a waste of judicial resources, there is a loss of efficiency, there is a waste of the litigant's time that's inherent in the trap as it exists right now.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please support Mr. David Furlow to that argument for response?
May I please the court? My name is David Furlow, and I represent Jim Ross and Doug Sutter, the respondents in this case. Your Honor, as a preliminary matter, we have a distinction between facts that are relevant to the 14th Court of Appeals dismissal of this appeal, and general principles of law suggest that this court should, in fact, clarify problems resulting from uncertainties regarding trial and appellate lawyers' understanding of Tier and Duddleston and the other cases that, admittedly, have engendered some confusion. We have then issues of the facts of this case and of the law in general. With respect to the facts of this case, I would wish to make several points. First, that the trial court in this case did not mean for this series of 8 interlocutory summary judgments to constitute a final judgment. Mr. Boyce has just appeared here on behalf of petitioners Moffridge and others. I would direct the court's attention specifically to page 1696 of the transcript and would request that this court consider page 1696 because it will demonstrate the problems that Justice Enoff was describing about determining when a judgment is final. It is our position that wishing it so does not make it so, and the inclusion of Mother Hubbard language, or worse yet, indefinite take-nothing language, or something else that might be the functional equivalent of Mother Hubbard or take-nothing, does not make an interlocutory summary judgment a final judgment, not in any circumstances. Specifically, transcript of page 1696, the court will find that on April 29th, in the third round of summary judgment orders that were granted by the court, the trial court deleted the word final from the order submitted by the Moffridge Group, which had said final judgment. That was deleted by the court's pen. And the court also deleted the last sentence that referenced the severance of that case. I would suggest that if Mr. Boyce's standard is to be used, and if we, or you as the Supreme Court, or any court of appeals, is to determine when a judgment is final by looking at the language of the judgment, then the first thing this court ought to do is look at the language of the order of partial summary judgment on behalf of the Maffridge Group, in which the trial court struck out the word final and struck out the severance provision, indicating that he did not wish that partial summary judgment to be made final by a severance, and that he, in fact, did not consider that summary judgment or any of the other summary judgments to be final.
But a series of partial summary judgments makes a final judgment.
Well, Your Honor,
so
that
is quite correct to strike it out of one judgment, because it was not final, but a series of them does become final.
Your Honor, a series of partial summary judgments may together constitute a final judgment under some circumstances. I would suggest that there are serious questions about whether a series of partial summary judgments here constitutes a final judgment under Rule 301 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, which requires that there be a final judgment. And I also have questions about whether the series of cobbled together partial summary judgments could constitute a final judgment under Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section 51.012.
Do you think there has to be a single piece of paper?
I think it would be better practice to consolidate a series of summary judgments into a final judgment.
Why?
That the court would sign. It would make it easier for attorneys to know when a case is final, when a judgment
so
is final.
So that if a case has lasted over years, and a summary judgment has been granted here, a summary judgment has been granted here, and you get to the end of it, and there's a settlement or something, and then you've got to go back and put all this into one judgment, dig it all out, put it into one judgment.
I'm not saying that it has to be done, Your Honor. I'm certainly saying that it would clarify for the court the importance of resolving the case at once. And it would make it easier for justices of the courts of appeal and of the Supreme Court to determine that a judgment was, in fact, final.
What proceedings are continuing in the trial?
Well, Your Honor, there were a number of claims that were not addressed by a number of these partial summary judgment orders.
Since these have been signed and appeal has been taken, what proceedings have been had in the trial?
None, Your Honor.
Why not?
I believe the parties have waited for the Court of Appeals to determine the fundamental issue.
if the trial court doesn't think this is final, looks like you'd be anxious about getting on it.
Well, that would depend upon what the parties did. The court would have no reason to take action if the parties did not seek some sort of action, and here the parties have come to the Court of Appeals, and Mr. Ross and Mr. Sutter came to the Court of Appeals because they were confronted with a dilemma.
You've not received any communication, I take it, from the trial court saying this is a pending case and I'm concerned about getting it resolved and please get on with it?
Your Honor, I have received no such communications. The broader point is that respondents Ross and Sutter, out of an abundance of caution, had no choice but to appeal at the time that they did, because under the standards of Tier and Duddleston, the arguments made by petitioner's counsel would suggest that there was a possibility that the judgments of the 8 orders of partial summary judgment might be considered a final summary judgment.
And given the current state of the law, anyone in your position would have to take an appeal.
In our position, we would have to take an appeal lest the attorney be considered to have committed malpractice by waiving the valuable right to an appeal. And under those circumstances, I agree with the petitioner's counsel that a bright line rule should be adopted. Yet I would ask this court not to adopt the rule suggested by the petitioners, because it is not a bright line rule. Petitioners, as I understand their argument, suggest that this court's bright line rule should be, one, a Mother Hubbard clause makes an interlocutory summary judgment final, and two, that take nothing language is the functional equivalent of a Mother Hubbard clause. That's how I understand that position. If I'm mistaken, then this court will have to struggle through my misinterpretation of it. But assuming that that is their two-point analysis and that that is their bright-line rule, it will cause confusion for all of them, for all trial attorneys, for the courts of appeal, and for this Supreme Court. It will increase substantially the number of appeals, because instead of having adhering to this court's standards that, as expressed in Cheshire, that a valid final summary judgment order must reflect a valid summary judgment motions address of all of the causes of action and all of the parties. Adoption of their rule will mean that a defendant may forget or choose not to address various causes of action, simply slap on the Mother Hubbard language, or worse yet, take nothing or some sort of variation thereof, and convert an otherwise interlocutory partial summary judgment into a summary judgment just by using the magic words.
Now, how does a defendant sign a judgment like that?
Your Honor?
How does a defendant sign a judgment like that?
The defendant does not sign a judgment.
If the trial judge signs a judgment.
Trial court.
And if the trial judge doesn't mean to do that, can't you point that out to the trial judge?
We certainly can, Your Honor.
And he can take it out.
And the judge can take it out.
If he leaves it in, it's a pretty fair assumption that he means for it to be.
And then, yes, Your Honor, that is absolutely correct, that he means it to be in. Here, however, we have instances where a number of the petitioners did not address all of the causes of action raised by the respondents in the trial court below. Further, we have an instance where a judge on April 29th, the third round of entering summary judgment orders, strikes out the word final and strikes out the severance provision. If we are going to, as Mr. Boyce has suggested, look at the language of the orders, then the language from the last April 29, 1991 round of summary judgment order strongly suggests that the court did not consider these orders to be final.
If you're right and the summary judgments did not address all the claims that your clients allege,
yes,
your clients have been rendered a disservice, I guess, by the status quo, because they had to appeal rather than risk that the judgment might become final. Now the Court of Appeals has struggled and expressed frustration with our writings on a subject and the appeal dismissed, so you're back in the trial court. You criticize differ, I guess, with the proposed rule that petitioners urge. Do you have a rule that you would urge us to adopt to address this problem?
The rule that I would ask this court to adhere to is the rule expressed in Cheshire and otherwise, which is that a partial summary judgment is not a final summary judgment unless one of two circumstances prevail. Either one, the partial summary judgment is in response to a partial summary, to a summary judgment motion that has addressed all parties and all issues, or two, the court, the trial court, makes a partial summary judgment final by virtue of severing out the judgment, the partial summary judgment that it is rendered.
Let's say we make that ruling. In your next case, when the judge does this and signs a judgment that says on its face that it's final, but it's not, are you going to appeal or not?
Of course I'm going to appeal, Your Honor.
So the rule doesn't do any good?
No, Your Honor. I'm drawing a distinction between saying it is so, for example, including Mother Hubbard language.
What I'm saying.
Right.
I'm saying if we have this rule, in your next case, when you get a summary judgment that has Mother Hubbard language in it, but you know from looking at the file, or your position is, from looking at the file, this is not final, are you going to appeal?
Of course, Your
Honor. Or are you going to sit there and say, no, I've got a Supreme Court case that says this isn't final?
Your Honor, if a motion for summary judgment filed by a defendant has addressed only three of the four causes of action my plaintiff has alleged, and the court signs a judgment with Mother Hubbard language,
you're still going to appeal.
I'm still going to appeal because
I've got to. So this rule doesn't do any good.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest it simply reiterates the rule that a judgment is final only if it addresses all the causes and all the issues. And
you know that. We know that. Maybe even the trial judge knows that. But nobody's going to take a chance, are they? They're still going to appeal.
They're still going to appeal, Your Honor. I can see that. The thing that I'm concerned about is the two-part rule proposed by the petitioners puts this court, and in fact all trial attorneys in Texas, in a very serious quandary, because at least, you know, if this court did nothing about its prior rulings and did not clarify any problems, you know, clarify any of the uncertainties between Tier and Duddleston, if this court did nothing, then at least trial attorneys would know that Mother Hubbard language out of the form book is the language that ought to be included in order to indicate a judgment's finality. What the petitioners are suggesting is that take nothing language, or the functional equivalent thereof, serves the same purpose, which means that instead of a bright line rule, we'll move to a situation where everything has to be appealed because there will never be certainty as whether take nothing language in the context of a particular situation indicates finality. When Mr. Boyce talks about looking at the language of the judgment and all of the other circumstances of the case, it means there is no right line.
But if it has to be appealed anyway, which is what I take it you can see, why not address the merits while you're up there? Why make it a waterfall? If I go up, have the Court of Appeals say, this isn't final, go back, have the trial judge say, well, I thought it was, and I sure meant for it to be, so let me just say it in so many words. This is final. Go back up to the Court of Appeals and say, well, you can't grant a final summary judgment this way because you didn't address all these other claims. Send it back to the trial judge. Why do we play ping pong with this? Why not just get a decision on the merits of it first time up, since the first time up is inevitable?
Your Honor, because, I'm struggling to understand. The question, Your Honor. That's my fault. But,
if you get a judgment that looks final, you have to appeal it, whether you think it is or not.
That's correct.
If the Court of Appeals agrees with you that it's not final, then you go back to the trial judge, who signed it. And since it says final, he apparently thought it was final. So now he says this is really final. Then you go back up again. The Court of Appeals says, okay, it's final, but it's wrong. And now, in two appeals, you get the ultimate answer, which is you can't grant summary judgment on these claims because they're not comprehended in the motion and the papers, instead of in just one appeal.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that, as in this case, the Court of Appeals will, in discussing the jurisdiction, the fundamental jurisdictional issue, will point out the deficiencies in the partial summary judgments that do not constitute a final summary judgment. Here, the 14th Court of Appeals wrote a lengthy opinion pointing out specifically all of the various issues that various defendants had failed to address. That is simply a laundry list for the trial court in order to examine and come up with a judgment that gives everybody their day in court and allows the trial court to correct its previous errors.
But so if the trial court thinks he's already done it, he's just going to say, okay, I did that. And then you're right back up.
I would submit that any trial court that would ignore a court of appeals laundry list of the various deficiencies in his judgment might perhaps be the subject of a mandamus proceeding.
No, he's not ignoring it. He's trying to comply. But he thinks he already has complied. He wouldn't have signed the final judgment.
That is why we have a court of appeals, in order to correct the misunderstandings of trial court judges.
Counsel, is there any, there appears to be some confusion that arose out of the language in Tier, as Mr. Boyce argued, that purported to draw distinctions between judgments rendered after conventional trials and summary judgments. Do you,
going back to Aldridge? Going back to Aldridge, Your Honor? I think the Tier is correct in terms of saying that Mother Hubbard language has no place in the context of a partial summary judgment, or to put it in slightly different terms, a trial court cannot make a partial summary judgment based on a partial motion for summary judgment that failed to address all issues. A trial court cannot make a final simply by saying it is final. There's got to be an underlying motion addressing each of the causes and each of the parties. If it's not there, summary judgment's never going to be final.
So you're using the term partial summary judgment, or the phrase partial summary judgment, to refer to something that's called a partial summary judgment that tries to knock out perhaps one cause of action or one element of one cause of action, and a comprehensive motion for summary judgment, or at least one entitled motion for summary judgment that goes to the whole case, that perhaps omits addressing a single cause of action.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, there are distinctions. That is precisely the point. I would suggest that fundamentally there are distinctions between a partial summary judgment, which we might call an issue partial summary judgment, that disposes of one issue, versus a party summary judgment that disposes of all of the claims brought by one party and perhaps the counterclaims, and a final judgment that disposes of all of the parties and all of the issues. As I read Rule 301, there can only be one final judgment in the case, and this series of eight interlocutory partial summary judgments, some of them bearing indications that, well, some of them bearing indications as far as the Mappers group that it was not part of, indicates that the issue that there was no final judgment in the case, in the court below, the trial court below, because not all the parties were addressed, not all the claims were addressed. Thus, jurisdictionally, not all the parties were addressed, not all the claims were addressed, it can't be a final judgment. The Court of Appeals correctly recognized that it had no jurisdiction over an interlocutory, partial summary judgment not severed out. It correctly dismissed.
So we're right back where we started. That is, an erroneous summary judgment denies the Court of Appeals of jurisdiction.
That is correct, Your Honor. And perhaps it would be easier just to allow the Court of Appeals to say, okay, we don't have jurisdiction, but we're still going to get to the meat of the issue, look at this and say, well, enough of this. Let's put this case to an end. I would suggest that that is incorrect, in that if the Court of Appeals has no jurisdiction, or if the Texas Supreme Court has no jurisdiction over the case, it must dismiss and adhere to the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure and the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, rather than taking the alluring shortcut to say, well, even if we don't have jurisdiction, we're still going to decide. It's a shortcut, but it's wrong.
Well, no one is suggesting, I don't think, that the Court of Appeals decide cases they don't have jurisdiction over. There's a difference between not having jurisdiction and the judgment just being wrong. Is that correct? And this can be looked at either way. The judgment says it's final, and it's not. It may be because it's wrong, or because it's interlocutory.
As I understand that argument, that is correct. And as in this instance, the 14th Court of Appeal, dealing with a situation like that, concluded that it had no jurisdiction and that the summary judgments were wrongly entered because a number of parties failed to address some of the claims asserted by respondents Ross and Southern in the proper below. One final matter, I would just request that the court, in examining this case, if the court is to find that Mother Hubbard language has continuing validity indicating the trial court's belief that a judgment is final, I would simply request the court not to confuse the issue further by throwing away the clear, bright line of Mother Hubbard language and relying upon take nothing or functional equivalent, which will mean that every case will be unsolved.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Hannon, I have a question for you. Do you agree that judgments that are inherently, that are interlocutory judgments are not made final by mere inclusion of the Mother Hubbard clause? I'm not talking about partial summary judgments now. I'm talking about judgments that are interlocutory on their face are not made final by the inclusion of Mother Hubbard clauses.
Well, I think they are made final. I think they're wrong, such as Justice Heck just suggested. They may be erroneous, they may be wrong, and the Court of Appeals may have to reverse them. And that might be true in certain instances.
So if there are cases that say judgments that are inherently interlocutory are not made final by the inclusion of Mother Hubbard clauses, you'd say we should disavow that language and that your rule that you propose really is a rule that would go as to all judgments of the trial court.
If
Mother Hubbard clause is in the judgment, it is a final judgment.
If I can take a long way of answering that, Judge, with the court's permission, I think we need to correct what actually happened in this case, because I think it'll clear up what happened and help answer your question. And that is, the defendants all made motions for summary judgment. All except one. And the court granted them over a passage of time. And unlike what Mr. Furlow said, and I'm not accusing him of trying to mislead the court or anything, because he wasn't one of the trial lawyers. He was hired to argue this case. What happened was they were all granted, including the one he referenced for Mafferty and Chromatic, that had the final language. Well, the court crossed out that final language because there was one party who hadn't moved. And then what happened, they wanted to appeal the case, the respondents in this case, and they non-suited the remaining defendant. And in fact, the day they non-suited it, on May 14, 1991, at 2:21, they filed the non-suit. At 2:23, and this is all in the record, they filed a notice of appeal, and in the notice of appeal they say, this is taking these interlocutory summary judgments and making them final so we can appeal. So they made the case appealable by non-suiting the sole defendant. The trial court was correct in what they did by crossing out the final because there was still a party left. We were correct in following TIER, because we followed the language in TIER, where Judge Pope said, you can't have a Mother Hubbard language that purports to decide a case for a party that wasn't even there, that wasn't even moving. In that case, the City of Bel Air hadn't even filed a motion for summary judgment, and Judge Herb granted a summary judgment on its behalf, and the Court of Appeals affirmed as to all three parties, and what Judge Pope said is, just because there's Mother Hubbard language that's there, you can't grant a motion that hadn't been filed, which brings us back to your question. Think, and I hope I'm being responsive, and that is what the court did and what Judge Pope did in that case. He didn't say, we don't have jurisdiction like the court below said. What he said is, it's wrong. It's wrong. It was right as to the two parties that moved and did it correctly. But when the Mother Hubbard language picks up that third party, which it purported to do in the TIER case, it was erroneous and wrong. It's not that we don't have jurisdiction, because as Justice Heck suggested, the defense counsel didn't sign it, the trial court signed it. So it was the judgment of the trial court. He was just incorrect.
But in that case, the judgment specifically granted summary judgment in favor of Bel Air.
Right.
There wasn't any question that there was this general language, Mother Hubbard, in that. Mother Hubbard was not an issue in that particular case because the judgment itself specifically granted judgment for Bel Air.
Well, it's my understanding that's not necessarily correct, and maybe, you know, the court knows more about Tier, y'all decided it, but it's my understanding from reading the opinion that Bel Air kind of got swept up by the Mother Hubbard language. And that's how the city of Bel Air, who hadn't even moved for a summary judgment, got a summary judgment granted in their favor.
So a summary judgment is final if it says that the plaintiff takes nothing as to all parties, or says any relief not granted is denied.
I think it is, Your Honor. It may be wrong, but it's final.
As long as you hit all parties, even though you don't address all claims in the motion. So is that a bright line test we can...
I think it's a bright line test the court can use. I don't think you need to use it to reverse this case. I think this case is reversible on the existing law. We followed TIER. It became final, not by us moving, but by them non-suiting the final defendant. But I think that is a bright line case you could use, and then the Court of Appeals can do, as Justice Heck suggested, decide the case, and if there is some error, send back the parties that have committed error or didn't have something in their motion and affirm as to those that did.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second call. The court will take another brief...